Good morning and welcome to the ULT in Philadelphia. We are a group of independent students who work collectively helping one another to understand the ideas that Theosophy puts forth. We consider as Theosophists anyone who is working to help humanity in whatever form that might take. We may not consider it a big gift, but to someone else, something we did or said or even a smile made their day. So anyone who is in the service of another would be called a Theosophist. And these teachings are ancient from the night of time and hold truth. And we are told truth needs to be reckoned independently, that we try it out for ourselves. As an independent group rather than an organization, we do not have officers, bylaws, collect dues, any of the things you would see in a membership type setup. Rather, our meetings are open to the public. We survive completely on voluntary donations of time, service, and money. And everybody's tight these days in their wallet. So we say even a dollar given with the right feeling in their heart goes a long, long way. So, can I have that, please? Thank you. We have two meetings during this season. And it has gotten cool today. It's reminding us the seasons are changing. Sunday mornings, as today, doors open at 10:30. Our meeting runs from 11 till noon. And this month, the overall topic is the fundamentals of Theosophy. So it's a good review month for those who are acquainted with them. And it's wonderful to hear them given out in the different topics over the 4 weeks if you haven't heard them before. So today is the foundation of universal unity, but next week is karma, the law of justice and mercy. On Wednesday evenings we have a study class, and we're currently working in the Ocean of Theosophy. And there is a schedule for that behind the lady at the usher seat there. All of the straight line teachings are available at the book table for just the cost of printing and shipping. We are non-profit. So if you're interested, and they're online for free as well, and we'll direct you where to find them if you so choose. And we encourage, bring a friend, talk to someone. If you find these ideas interesting, they may as well, or they may find it on their own. So this morning, the foundation of universal unity, we're going to look at it from the point of view of the universal and invisible, and then the particular, how this is seen in matter. So we'll start with the universal side.
We often think, when we look at the word unity, we're not quite sure what that is. Because if we look in the world today, it looks very fragmented, much confusion, and much unrest. Well, that's only seemingly so, because the idea of unity is founded in our very nature. We have affinity for all of life. And we, as a human being, must come to a realization of what this unity is and how we are a part of it. Because that firm foundation of truth is where we can stand and how we can look at the rest of life from that standpoint, from that foundation. In the ancient writings, we come across a symbol, a white disc surrounded by a dark background. Now, the ancients considered this an expression of that divine unity. It is the unknowable, the unseen, the eternal and boundless aspect of the universe. That this truth is the foundation of our collective oneness. We are given certain truths, but do not believe anything that is said to you. You must check, test it, and verify it for yourself, and see where the inherent truth lies. We cannot give you these ideas. We can share ideas with you, but you take with you that which you want and need. So this idea of unity, or supreme unity, is an expression of our spiritual nature. We are told a couple of analogies when we first come in these rooms, that we are as a drop in that great ocean. We are as a ray of that great sun. We are all part of this unity, even though it is portrayed in a myriad of shapes and forms and colors and smells. It is all one. So we often hear the expression, this is the one life, because we are inextricably bound together with everything else that exists. We are responsible for that little sphere in which we live, but also to expand that sphere, to become larger and larger and larger, to embrace more. We embrace our families, and we embrace those around us. But unity is a fact in nature. Without unity, nothing would exist. It's stated, what, 500 BC, Leucippus said that the atom had lateral motion. Well, what does that mean? That means it has affinity. It has affinity for other atoms. And we are the same. Look at the bodies in which we have inherited, in which we use. They have affinity for each other. And they are directed by that mind being who inhabits them. So we are the microcosm of the macrocosm. We are the universe which we see outside of us. But the reality, it dwells inside. Well, if I'm a unity, then universal brotherhood is not an ideal, but a fact. So if we examine that fact, we look at the mineral kingdom, the vegetable kingdom, the animal kingdom, and then the human kingdom. We see a natural progression of affinities, of minerals having affinities for each other. Some repel each other, but there are affinities that bind things together. Mineral kingdom is inherently cohesive. And then the vegetable kingdom is inherently response to light. There is an intelligence within all of life. All of life is intelligent. And then the animal kingdom, we certainly know, is intelligent. And then the human. The human kingdom is the apex, or the pinnacle of evolution. And we say, oh, wow, we are? My, oh, my. But then we are reminded to look in our history, look in our religions. What do they tell us? That man is perfectible. They don't say that, but they worship beings who perfected themselves in prior periods of evolution. That perfectibility is a natural process, a natural affinity for this idea of universal brotherhood. We have an affinity for each other. We have an affinity to love one another. We must live in our hearts and minds, and we must, in this age of psychism and passivity, we must subdue that lower nature and pursue those higher aspects which this philosophy gives us. For we are told that the universe evolves from within outward. That is us. We evolve from within outward. So we need to come and firmly grasp the ideas that will change our life and will change our understanding, and will see that we are not separate, even though that is what we see. But that is the great heresy, the feeling of separateness, because we are not separate. The more we realize the oneness of life, the more we become a willing worker for all that aids suffering humanity. And we don't know what particular calling or interest you have, but in this philosophy, in this religious study, in this scientific endeavor, we can prove to ourselves that there is a oneness. We see a body that is composed of all other aspects of all the other kingdoms below us. We stand as the ruler of all this, and we can either raise it up, raise ourselves up, and raise humanity up with thinking or with ideas that are based on truth. That we are one, we are not separate, and we are given the great opportunity to right those wrongs that we have incurred in past lives. It's called karma. And we do that by reincarnating life after life after life, endeavoring to make things a oneness and to aid our families and those that we love, truly aid them with the true ideas of who we are. We are gods in potential, but only in potential. One must work and must sacrifice that which is so loved and so sacred to us, is our feelings and who we are in this material world. We must quiet those rumblings of our passions and realize that we are all together and we are not separate.
So that beginning, that circle of no color on the black background, is the first form we are given to consider. Think of it. It has no beginning and no ending. It is perfect in its shape. Both sides are absolutely equal. It is the shape of oneness. The next symbol that's given in the secret doctrine is the point in the middle, the point in the circle, which is representative of the first emanation or the first impulse or the first idea of what is to come. And what is to come is that great evolution that was discussed. So from there, everything comes forward, as was said, from inward, outward. My job is to have us look this morning at the outward expressions of that symbol of oneness, and if we can recognize it for what it is. So we were thinking about it, the starting with the fetus, the oval shape, the egg, again, oval or circular, the sun. These symbols are all around us, and we just go about our day. But there is intelligence not only in us, but in the kingdoms of great nature. My partner said we are made up of all of those parts of great nature. So what is within them is within us, and we are coming forward at a time when we are a little bit more highly developed than the highest kingdom of nature, because mind becomes lit up, and that gives us choice. So from the moment that responsibility comes about, we have the choice for how we will affect nature. And we were thinking, there's so many examples, but we had seen a show on fractals, and they took a large forest, a great large piece of land, and started from the seedlings and measured and copied the forms and then trees as they grew and the older trees, and then looked out even further to the whole shape of the forest. Every single one of them was exactly the same, a copy of the other. Even the shape of the forest itself took the shape of each tree, and each tree with its branches and leaves and so forth was exactly the same. And they may have been sitting differently, so they look different to our eye. But this was nature intelligently using a form that was appropriate for what it had to do. We miss these things. Unless we're the explorer type, we would never see something like that. The behavior of animals, often when we think it was elephants in particular, there was a sick child, baby elephant, and the pack would not move on until that baby elephant either got well or died. So there's a oneness there without thinking, this one is ill, we'll wait for it, but rather a natural impulse, part of our group, part of this oneness needs our attention. So it's amazing that even with just natural impulse, which is spiritual and intelligent at its base, there is expression of that in nature. The kingdoms of nature then that were mentioned start out as spirit and matter, the entity we call the monad or the monad. And that guiding element experiences through every kingdom along the way of evolution everything there is to learn in each kingdom before it moves on. This is the evolutionary process. Who's at the top waiting till the time is right but man? When the form is ready, when that intelligence has learned all it can, man takes on the form of a human, basically oval-shaped if you think of standing up. And again, that responsibility to everything that helped make it. Now, what nature does for us is too much for us to even think about, but it's our outlet. It feels what we feel. It is so connected to us that when we rage with anger, maybe not at that moment, but sometime, somewhere, there will be a terrible storm if there's enough energy put forth. On the other hand, if there's enough love and altruism and brotherhood shown, nature blossoms and feels that and grows stronger. So it is intimately connected with man and what man does and how he operates in his life. Spirit is in, Mr. Crosby says, spirit is invisible, yet can we think of a place where spirit is not? Spirit is everywhere, in everything, the cause, the sustainer of all that was, is, or ever shall be. So we're given the idea of space. And again, the only thing we can formulate is some kind of giant globular shape. That's naturally how we think about it, if we think of borders to it. And there is nothing outside of space. Everything is within that spiritual oneness, is a reflection of it, is touched by it, is... The one is energized by that and has the opportunity to use it appropriately. All our powers rest upon that one spiritual nature. The limitations placed upon the power to express are not made by any external force whatever, but made by ourselves, by the ideas that we hold. So we'd like your thoughts and questions.
When we look at the progress of the fetus, it starts out as a globular form and then proceeds to go through all the different kingdoms. Can we also look at that example of being unity as well?
Well, we must remember that everything is a unity, or because all of life is intelligent. Life has an affinity for itself. So the fetus is only a recapitulation of that evolutionary process that the form goes through. And then this is the human kingdom. You know, each kingdom is separate and distinct. Man is not the product of the animal kingdom. The human form is not, it uses other kingdoms, but it is not an evolutionary process from that kingdom. There is a distinct human kingdom.
And we were shocked to hear the phrase this way one day when we were looking at, probably in school, how the cells at the very beginning stages of life, how the cells operate. They split into two and split into two. So the teacher said they multiply by dividing, which was just, that phrase, we worked with that phrase for a long time. It's like the two sides of one hand. We multiply by dividing. We are spirit and matter. And the forms that the fetus goes through resembles the different kingdoms in different stages. It's a wonderful study.
Bye.
Follow up on that. It was pointed out that monadic essence, or that spiritual unity, has to go through and experience all the kingdoms before it works through the human state. So wouldn't the memory or the reflection of all that experience be in the monad and come out through that fetus? It's sort of an evidence or a recapitulation of everything that intelligence has been through.
Absolutely. There's a natural impulse in that kingdom. For instance, the vegetable kingdom, the natural impulse would be the things growing turn towards the sun. If you, they, especially sunflowers, they track their path throughout the day. And as the sun moved over the sky, they would turn towards it. So the intelligence that was gained in the previous lifetimes, in different forms perhaps, yes, would come through in the next. But that was your question?
Paul.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Well, if we looked at it usually from the point of view of Western or materialistically oriented science, those forces spoken of in the kingdoms would seem to be, unintelligent, just reactionary, cause and effect. But it seems that what Theosophy is suggesting, that force is not blind, it's the expression of intelligence. Is there a way we can prove to ourselves that force is not blind, is not chaotic, is not just mechanical, but is really the expression of will or thought, something like that?
Well, we have to just perhaps to look at the bodies we inhabit. How do we make it move? How do we help it survive? How can it grow? You know, we feed it, we nurture it. It is a unity. It is the world, the universe, in miniature. So that the idea that being separate is not the reality. The reality is that we are inextricably linked between and among each other. One of those links is karma. But there are other, and there are other ones that are physical and so forth, heredity, you know. But we are ever becoming as a human being, and this instrument is being perfected lifetime after lifetime. As we become more spiritual, our forms will change, but that is an expression of spirit. The forms don't change unless the expression of that which is hidden within us begins to show itself. And there needs to be means by which we can express it. And right now, we only have words, and we find them very inadequate. But as the mind opens, as time progresses, the mind will open and embrace a larger understanding of life. And it's said that also that the next element will begin to appear, and that's the ether, the akasha, that lower aspect, which to us is, we cannot see it, but exists. But as we evolve further and further, that will become visible. And many other things will change because of that. So we are ever moving forward. We don't fall back. We move forward. And sometimes that if we do fall back, we are constantly helped and checked to reassert that positive aspect, which is life.
But we think the question mentioned the kingdoms of nature as well, we believe. So we were thinking, how does the cheetah or the ant know to eat this leaf but not this one? How does something in the plant kingdom know it's okay to climb as a vine along this tree, but not this one? This one would be toxic. There's no handbook. Even in the micro kingdoms, how do antibiotics become unusable? Just because this patient, it didn't work in this patient, this patient who's never used them before, now it doesn't work in any of them. There's a communication. There's a oneness and a some mysterious but definitely spiritual and intelligent communication among the kingdoms. And we're thinking that a couple years ago there were some trees that were getting disease on them. So we kept spraying the diseased trees. The next year, the trees we had left alone were just fine. The trees we had sprayed died. So nature, in a sense, will intelligently take care of itself if we work with it rather than against it. And look at it for examples. It's amazing.
And we have to remember, if we look at all the kingdoms, the mineral kingdom sacrifices itself to the vegetable kingdom. The vegetable kingdom sacrifices itself to the animal kingdom. And the animal kingdom sacrifices itself to man. We don't sacrifice anything, these lower kingdoms. We think that it is all for our use. And unfortunately, that is not the correct doctrine, that it is one. We are all a part of it. And how we treat it has effect on us, but it has an effect on everyone. We are not so puny in ways that we think. We are told that we are electromagnetic and our minds are dynamos.
Yes,
you hear
him,
so I believe in the idea of unity, both intellectually and intuitively.
Can we speak up?
I believe in the idea of unity intellectually and intuitively. And there have been moments when I felt like I've experienced that and felt that. But the interesting thing is those only happen at times when there is no individual to experience it. Somehow the idea of a perfected individual trying to experience unity is oxymoronic. It doesn't make sense. By definition, there's a separate part trying to experience the whole. So the only way that I think you can experience the whole as a unity and to truly feel it is to be that entire, you know, whole. So an individual can't experience, the whole.
I'm trying to figure out.
Well, if you're speaking of how we individually can experience the whole,
I can't feel like I'm a part of everything unless I meld myself into it.
Well, yes. Yeah. I mean.
But then the individual disappears, is what I'm saying. So the idea of a perfected individual being able to experience everything to me doesn't make any sense.
Okay. That's a different question.
Well, the answer to that question in this mind is that we have examples of perfected beings. We have they're everywhere. In the Western mind we have Plato, Pythagoras, we have Jesus, we have Muhammad, we have Krishna, we have Zoroaster. And we have multitude of monks and sages throughout Asia that have experienced that oneness. And those that can hold on to that transmit that oneness through their very being. Because this all-knowing is this oneness. And we as human beings can reach that in this life, or in manifested life. But again, it takes effort and direction. You're not going to be given this. You have to try and find that gem that's buried deep.
And there's a lot of hands, just real quickly. Although perfected, that one has control over every element of its being, and can still see the individuals that need help. So it stands apart from, yet is still connected to, the individual. We hear what you were saying, but there's never a separation unless the perfected one chooses to go into nirvana for the end of that period. But the ones that were mentioned, like Buddha and Krishna and Christ, that come back to help are in a type of vesture that makes them singular beings again in order to help where it's necessary. They are still fully perceptive of the oneness, but they choose to come back and help as well.
I mean, but that very fact is why they need us, companions, those that can do the work on this plane and make it ready for them to again be a part of this material existence. Can you speak up, please?
So the University of Virginia, they've been studying empathy. And so empathy. And what they've done was they put some students into these MRI tubes and scanned their brains. And so they told them they were about to, they basically said you could receive an electric shock. And the students' brains all lit up in ways in which they were concerned about themselves. And then they said to the students, actually, we may shock one of your friends. And I guess they knew ahead who their friends were. And they saw which part of the brains lit up. And then they said, okay, we'll shock this person that you don't know, as a different part of the brain lit up. And what they realized was that if it's someone you care about, you love, someone who's your friend, you identify with them so much that it's the same part of the brain that lights up in the same almost intensity than compared to a stranger that you don't know. And right. So what if empathy that the masters had perfected was the fact that they could feel that love for every single person. There was no stranger to them. We were all, to them, one of them. And so it's interesting in terms of understanding how we're actually wired, having these fMRI test studies show that how we define empathy or how we feel empathy is such that we actually identify another person as being part of us.
We're getting there.
Yes.
Yes.
To go back to the contribution before that, the individual started by saying that I have experienced unity. Well, the fact that the person can say I experienced it and talk about that experience shows that they did not lose their individuality, that I, while experiencing. What was lost, though, it had to be suppressed in a sense to experience that, was the sense of personality. I am this condition, I am that condition, which separates us from identifying with other people and with the oneness.
Absolutely.
That has to be lost.
Absolutely. Anything we can think of as different, if we look at one another and see a different hair color, a different eye color, different weight, different height, we are getting farther and farther away from the truth. If we look in another's eyes, we see a soul, and we are a soul as well. So it's exactly the same. There's something like there's a 2% difference in the body, one from another, 4%. Everything else is exactly duplicative. So thinking about it, and that's where it begins in the thinking and the ideas we hold, that we are not separate from one another. That's said to be the greatest heresy to hold the idea that we are.
In the back, the 4%?
Yeah, there's an interesting fact in nature that's very easy to study. And the comment about the eyes brought it to mind. We know that our pupils contract and expand, and there's plenty of research that as those pupils contract, take in less light, the individual soul living in that body is more constricted. When the pupil begins to enlarge, when a baby looks at its primary caregiver, or vice versa, or two friends meet each other, those pupils expand and get larger. And again, it's like that symbol of the point in the circle contracting and expanding. And ultimately speaking, as soul begins to develop and shines through any physical form,
that I will expand greater and greater, not just for the face of the mirror, not just for the face of the primary caregiver, but to the eye of anyone, the symbol in each and all. It's a very interesting study, and it's easy to do.
Thank you. It is the perfect representative of the point in the symbol. Yes.
In 1776, we used the word independence.
Mm-hmm.
It was a war of independence, it was called. And yet we're calling ourselves the United States of America.
And
we used the word independence and getting to that place. Well, it appears that there's been a war here in order to maintain that United States. And what why is that necessary to have the type of government that we do have in order to maintain that sense of independence and still be one?
Well, we think you are touching on the very existence of the United Lodge of Theosophists, because you have to be individually devoted to the cause of Theosophy. Individual devotion. But we must have a similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching which unites all of us together. It's an unselfish or a selfless action when you are keeping alive in this world today these ancient truths in a public forum with no one being taken out and burned at the stake or beheaded or being locked up, because we have come from that to this, and we have earned this right to study these ideas in a public forum.
In the daylight.
You know, this is not just an accident that we are here together. These are ancient ties that we have for each other, affinities that we experience. And when we come together, as we so want to do, with a common purpose, much can be done. But the personality must be kept in check. The personal idea has destroyed many unities, but it's not about the one, it's about the all.
And it has to be realized independently. No matter who gave you, if we think about over the course of our lives, we've been offered many, many kinds of ideas and beliefs and systems of thought and religions and philosophies, and they filled our head and we held them for a while, and perhaps they got us excited and we studied them and, well, this sounds right, but this doesn't. So we checked it, it's not correct, it doesn't fit with what we know. So independently, we have to do that work, or it doesn't help us at all. Independently, we have to go through school and take the test. If we cheat on another's paper when we need that information, we won't have it because we haven't done the work. So, yes, we are independently devoted, and the unity that they were foreseeing was a hope for this land, you know, given where we had come from. And they knew that it would take independence to do that. Yes?
The Declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists talks about universal brotherhood. And when somebody gets up on the platform and gives and recites the fundamental propositions, we talk about that theific essence, that we're all a ray of it, which justifies the idea of universal brotherhood. And so as we progress along our spiritual journeys, then we may be losing what had been mentioned about our personalities. But as we lose those personalities, we are gaining more of that spiritual essence. We are becoming aware of realization. That deific essence that we are. So it's not as if we're going to be losing ourselves. We will be losing that personal self, but that spiritual self will still be there. And just two examples of how the kingdoms are, just quickly, the kingdoms know about each other. We have heard multiple examples of people in the ocean being protected from sharks by dolphins. There's some kind of an affinity between dolphins and humans. And we think to some extent the same with the elephants, that there's some kind of connection. So we know that there is that fact of universal brotherhood.
Yes.
Well, it states in the Declaration, through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. So that profounder conviction is based on three fundamental principles that are introduced to the minds of the West in the Secret Doctrine in the very beginning. It talks about the oneness of life, from which everything comes, that is eternal, balanced, immutable, and omnipresent. And then that it periodically comes forth and retracts, just as our lives. We die, we go into our heaven state, and we are reborn again. The universe does the same thing. We go to sleep at night and we wake in the morning. The universe is no different. We are a microcosm of the macrocosm. We are great beings. We have to understand that and understand how we are great beings.
Yes.
Could it be possible that there is only one self, but there is only one I that is truly like eternal? And so it's the experiencing of that, as opposed to there's a million individual selves. So it's a self with a big X.
Yes, we would certainly say that that is true. There's like a universal oversoul. There's that realization is not isolated, and it's one that everyone can experience. But it is not an isolated experience per se.
As long as we realize with the capital S self, there's the lower S self, while we are in incarnation, that there is that spark of the oneness, the spiritual reflection, and the higher intelligence. And there is also, as we heard earlier, the man with the affinities and the tendencies and the desires. And until we are able to, it's still one being, but until we are able to change the desires to those of a higher nature and begin to work in that direction, we won't have a realization that there is a higher being within the being that. And we need a witness. We wouldn't be able to talk about this unless there was a witness watching us go through this life and make change and mistake after mistake after mistake, with the possibility to change at any moment. Way in the back.
So the analogy, if there's a beingness that is one, that gradually blooms, as it were, through the different kingdoms. The exercise for the finite mind might be to recognize that there's a particular role. We might be, I don't know, sitting in a restaurant and realizing that there's a series of different humans acting as parents. And we're able to watch the role of parent being experienced from a number of different vantage points with a number of different behaviors, when the impulse, the mind behind that activity of parenting is all one, but the expression is many. The experience is drawn or many, and they can be synthesized again by an observer saying, wow, look at the commonality, but look at the diversity. So it might be that the being-ness is like the I. The observer is still a personal mind looking at form and expression, but interpreting that and processing that is spiritual versus personal.
Absolutely. And we, for ourselves, try and envision that circular motion and have beingness becoming being, becoming beingness, which is the whole round of civilization and evolution. But yes, and those clicks, those moments where it all makes sense and the light bulb goes on, hold on to those and really let them fill your being. Because if it's truth, you know it. It feels different. It sounds different. Every fiber of your being knows that is right from the work you just did. And let that fill you up. And that is part of this process. In the back there.
This unity that we are discussing has been studied in depth by Rupert Sheldrake with his theory of fields, and he documents how everything is interconnected through those fields that he is exploring. And I think that really is a documentation of this unity that is talked about in the Pacific Doctors and that we've been discussing for this past.
We don't quite understand the question.
It's a comment.
A comment?
Okay, Rupert Sheldrake. Rupert Sheldrake. Right. And we might consider those fields as the seven layered man or the seven layers of everything. We might find a correspondence in there. So Rupert Sheldrake was the name. Yes.
Well, what we're hearing this morning is that we are all united as a group, and every individual is a system of cooperative effort. And then we hear here the statement, we are what we have thought. And that tells us that our bodies do fine, provided they have a supervisor who is cooperative with caring for it. Body can't take care of itself by itself. So the term individuality, personality, health, and so forth, it seems to be all focused in the mind, how we think.
Yes.
So it seems that that's where we have to begin.
Check our thoughts. Absolutely, we are mind beings.
And we are what we think. Yeah. If we think we're sick, we're sick. If we think we're healthy, we can usually try to maintain that. Yes?
The first presentation this morning pointed to the obvious discord and chaos that we see around us, and the following comment was, and this is evidence of our unity. But many would look at it and say that that's evidence of our differences and separateness and inherent selfishness and sinfulness. Even. So how can we check and test and verify or prove ourselves which one of those approaches is closer to the truth? Is chaos, disorder, an evidence of our unity or our separateness?
Well, there would be no conflict if there wasn't unity, if there wasn't a basis for the whole. We see in human nature, the self wants to be grand and be the center of attention. By that reality alone, there is great discord is prompted. Now but that is only the selfish part of humanity. There's another part that we see that's in every facet of life. I mean, we have a society that we depend upon each other. We need each other. We get our food from each other. We get our comfort from each other. We get those lessons of life from each other. We are a humanity that is bound together, and that the ideas of our outside world have always been to divide us, to separate us one from the other. Well, this is part of the struggle for power and selfishness on this plane. That the real antidote is brotherhood, is not being selfish and not being critical of your neighbor, not talking and carrying tales one from another, not finding fault. These little actions and attributes, we form a better association with people, because conflict only breeds more conflict. If we stand and do not react, it does pass away. But we are human and we make our own decisions. And we come to these ideas so that we could change the world in which we live. We're all, maybe heart sick at how much suffering there is in the world. How much suffering. And how can we alleviate it? Well, as theosophists, change someone's mind, change their ideas, and their world will begin to change. But we have sown a lot of seeds of discord, and we must reap them. But we can transform those by how we react to them.
And then we have others who are working in soup kitchens and bringing clothes to those who are homeless, and the impulse of the opposite nature, which is the good, not the chaotic, but the singular impulse to help, is also there. It's just perhaps not seen or recognized, but yes.
So I just want to bring up studies and insights from behavioral economics and negotiations experts.
Can you speak up a little bit?
So what they found was, when you bring a bunch of people together to do negotiations and they come in with a zero-sum mindset, so that's win-lose. I win something, you lose, right? So they're competing against each other. So they're using a part of their brain that's based on drive-seeking and stress, fight or flight. And so oftentimes in these types of negotiations, they break down. They can't close a deal because two sides won't compromise. Now, there's a different type of mindset called collaboration, where the two sides exchange information and altruistically make offers that can meet the needs of the other party. So they prioritize what are the most important needs and the most positive outcome both sides can expect and how they can work together to achieve that. They find that in those negotiations, they actually create value. And so both sides come back sometimes with their expectations exceeded from what deal they could get, because they realize it's not just one object and I get it and you don't get it, but that object has all these different features and qualities that can be shared. And so they actually, like, for for oranges, one side might need the orange peel, sometimes one side needs the orange for juicing. So they can both win. One side might need an egg white, the other side needs the egg yolk. And they figure out ways of splitting it so that they can create more value for all the parties involved. And so the interesting thing is that they've done these studies over and over and over, and they find that collaboration, having a win-win mindset, always creates better deals and better relationships. So when the two parties meet again, they have a foundation of trust to work from, but the win-lose types of negotiators, they erode trust to the point where people may have residual anger and resentment for a long time. And so sometimes people try to apply this in negotiations by bringing two hostile parties to get to know each other, to enjoy each other's companies for a period of time before they start the negotiations. So you see this with groups who bring in Palestinians and Israelis to become friends first, and then to talk about their differences. Usually they'll find they have much more in common.
Well, we'll have to end on that note. This gives us all something to think about. And that we'd like to remind everyone that this lodge, as all the lodges, are on a voluntary basis of time, service, and money, and all are welcome to participate. Meeting adjourned.
No one fell asleep for doing okay.
Yeah, well, there were a couple that were nodding off.
Time nodding off.
Well, he was conked out the whole time. He didn't sleep last night.
I had to stop you when you were heading for Carmen, because whoever's got it is back there going. It would have led nicely, but you know.
We can say that part. Huh? It's a whole week away. You know, I'm talking about as much as I want it.
How are you?
Good, how are you?
I was struck very strongly when you said kingdoms in their succession sacrifice to one another, and then we sacrifice to be made.
Yeah.
It's kind of stirring, actually. We may think we make sacrifices, but my big question actually became, if some other kingdom said, now we have to sacrifice our lives, like, let's do it, would we actually equate that? It's like the fear of the science fiction world, like another, now we have to eat you. Oh, no, I mean, really, it's that simple.
I turned it off. I didn't know if I was supposed to. Yeah.